So I'm going to try to share a few perspectives on sort of the road ahead for our project and in some sense for our, if indeed we are a virtual agroecology department, as Adam suggested, some thoughts about where such a group might go. So I want to talk about, in other words, future roles for the core sort of innovation that we're on about here, this soil functional zone management. And I'll conclude with the idea that a certain form of transdisciplinarity is maybe the logical next step for this group. So let's take a look at you know what we might call kind of the prospectus in some sense. What does our group kind of offer to the world? And I would argue that the method of conservation tillage that we have been studying has very interesting potentials for, first of all, climate adaptation, in particular the changes in soils and cropping systems have potential to help withstand this coming sort of climate of fewer and bigger rainfalls. I think that this method of conservation tillage has relevance to the emerging horizon of conservation agriculture, which, if you're not familiar with the term, is essentially it's a strategy of sustainable intensification that involves limiting soil disturbance and improving cover and improving cropping system diversity. There are trade-offs in conservation agricultural systems. I think SFZM has some potential to reduce those trade-offs. And then a third sort of horizon is what I think of as food, energy, water intensification. So this is a particular form, again, of sustainable intensification of agriculture, but focused on the idea that triplet of food, energy, and water, these three fundamental kinds of life support that agriculture can offer to society could be enhanced. And I would argue that because SFZM supports temporal intensification and a number of other things, it's compatible with that so-called FEW intensification horizon. So these are all what we might think of as sort of complex problem opportunities. And what I mean by that is that they can also be thought of as wicked problems. And, you know, I'm sure everybody's fairly familiar with the definition of a so-called wicked problem. But, you know, in some sense, the key things are that wicked problems have, or complex problems have, all these different aspects to them. Very importantly, they're viewed very differently by different sectors in society. And very importantly, they are they're very hard to understand and they're very hard to predict. So that sort of makes them quite different from tame problems. And so if in fact all of the sort of high payoff opportunities to, you know, kind of make something of ourselves, as it were, by addressing these heavy hitter issues of climate adaptation and conservation agriculture and sustainable intensification, if we have to engage with those, then what indeed should a CAP project do? What should a virtual department think about doing? And so to my thoughts on that start with the concern that the prevailing, if you will, sort of theory of change of agricultural science, which I would argue is kind of the dominant theory of change, although not very often explicitly voiced at this meeting, is probably not adequate. And so what is that theory of change? It is that our role as agricultural scientists is principally creation of knowledge. There's an implicit assumption tied to that, that change is knowledge limited. In other words, if we fill knowledge gaps, as we always say we're going to do in all of our grant proposals, change will follow automatically. Or maybe it'll happen, you know, because other people will take our information and do good stuff with it, say at the level of innovation, transformation, governance. So in other words, we're pretty far removed from these social processes, which I think we'd all agree are what actually makes change happen. So a kind of a key premise about these wicked problems or complex opportunities or however we want to call them, is that what we're really dealing with is transformation in complex systems. And complex systems, I don't know if you how familiar you are, guys are with the notion of complex adaptive systems, but they essentially, as they're frequently sort of modeled, the idea is that they have a number of elements that, sort of form and grow up and reach a certain kind of maturity, and they're subject to processes of, or events of crises and death and rebirth. And the important things about them is that they're typically very well resilient. Say, corn and soybean agriculture can be thought of as an extremely resilient complex system. But they are susceptible to sudden transformative change when, you know, what we might think of as the kind of support systems that keep in place are somehow undermined. And so it follows from that, perhaps, that the primary goal, or actually not the, wanted to carefully say a primary goal of agricultural science addressing these complex problem opportunities is creating and supporting what people are starting to call transformational agency in complex systems. So, in other words, this is an answer to the question of, well, okay, so what should a project like our CAP project go on to do next? Should we create more knowledge? Should we fill more of the myriad, you know, knowledge gaps that clearly remain in our project? Or should we view our role in different terms? And my sort of suggestion to you is, let's think about the idea that if what society really has to do to deal with these complex problem opportunities that represent existential threats to us is achieve transformation in complex systems that are resilient but can be transformed, then maybe our role as an agricultural science or as a CAP project is to think about creating transformational agency. In other words, the capacity, a collective capacity, to make a qualitative, a genuinely transformational change in a complex system. And here, this kind of metaphor of the so-called adaptive cycle of a complex system is worth taking another look at. Notice what happens in this particular complex system, which is a forest, is that it grows up. It, for one reason or another, becomes susceptible to catastrophic fires, and then it burns down completely and is all completely destroyed. So I would say that that's not generally a good model for how we want to see the world to change. In other words, catastrophic, destructive, burn it all down. The events of yesterday, you know, make that particularly pressing in my mind. So, transformational agency, this ability to make change. And so let's ask, you know, how would agricultural research, how would agricultural science, like what we're trying to do, potentially produce this transformational agency, this ability to make genuinely qualitative change in, say, food and agricultural systems without kind of destroying them in the process. And so transdisciplinary research is sort of emerging as a way that agricultural research can help produce transformational agency. And there's a couple of established sort of senses of transdisciplinarity. The more academic definition is the first of those, which is sort of what you're supposed to be able to accomplish by being interdisciplinary. The broader definition of transdisciplinary work is that it's research, but it's not just academic or scholarly research. It's actually knowledge creation that draws on a wide range of knowledge sources. And so the implication, I would say, for our project is that if we do, in fact, feel that this particular zonal management strategy that we have developed and explored, if we feel that it could really make a difference in climate adaptation and conservation agriculture and sustainable intensification, then perhaps what we should be doing as we go forward is really trying to commit ourselves to working in a genuinely transdisciplinary way. And so let me just illustrate for you what that could look like so that it's not just a complete abstract hypothetical. Our current grant proposals, not all of which have been rejected, Rich listed there, all address the question of essentially the broader question of can we make, can we extensively transform agricultural landscapes in the Midwest to be more multifunctional, to produce more food, more water, more energy. The general strategy for that, as illustrated by these visualizations that my friend Lisa Schulte Moore made a while ago, is adding perenniality and other kinds of diversification to complement, not entirely replace, annual crops. And so our next round of proposals, that are all on several which are under review, and if they come your way, please be kind, are all asking what is the role of zonal management in these watersheds, and what specifically could the role of that be in creating these more multifunctional kinds of watersheds. The proposals engage us as a group in a larger social transdisciplinary process, which folks are starting to call transdisciplinary watershed design. And I want to tell you a few things about that. So this transdisciplinary process, first of all, is not a static thing, but a dynamic and recursive thing. It is intended to engage and integrate multiple knowledge sources, specifically knowledge produced by science and knowledge produced by other knowledge creators in the right hand. We could call it the sort of societal learning and knowing loop. Importantly, a humanities discipline is central. So if we're talking transdisciplinarity, we're not just talking different disciplines of natural science. We're getting beyond the scope of this meeting, for example. And we're not just talking social sciences. We're talking arts, humanities, and design as having an integral role. And in particular, landscape design is the sort of key thing. Design is at the center of a critical process here, which is considering possible and preferred designs for these sort of high-performance Midwestern watersheds, if you will. They must be created, they must be deliberated, and there must be values-based discussions that consider possible ways forward. And very importantly, implementation, although we call it research, it's actually very closely tied, this sense of transdisciplinarity is very closely tied to action. So it's very closely tied to cycles of action and then further knowledge creation. And just let me finish up very briefly by describing our experience with actually applying transdisciplinary landscape design in a real place. Our particular version of it we call collaborative geodesign. And in a somewhat separate project group from the PZM group, but now our partners in these current proposals, we convened this almost year-long workshop series in a watershed in Minnesota in which we convened folks from agriculture, conservation, and regional governance communities and brought them together for around the prospect of could we take a look at a watershed, the watershed of Seven Mile Creek in south central Minnesota, and think about the idea of a so-called community-based bioeconomy, which would be a broader vehicle for these diversified watersheds that would produce more food, more water, more energy. In our workshops, we were very keen to integrate knowledge, so we brought people together and used many sheets of large paper to pool knowledge about a lot of different facets of this watershed. And what we were able to come up with were some broadly acceptable criteria for landscape and land use design if we were to produce, if we were to try to work together to transform Seven Mile Creek into one of these highly multifunctional watersheds, what were the key things we wanted to keep in mind? So that was a very values-based conversation, and it was also a knowledge and information-based conversation. We then wheeled in some technology to support this transdisciplinary landscape design, or our geodesign technology, as we call it, a bunch of big touch screens that we loaded up into a truck and hauled down to south central Minnesota. We created this whole sort of geodesign system that essentially presented lots of information about the watershed that was very accessible by users who could visualize or not visualize information as they saw fit. We allowed them to design with multiple different alternative land practices, which at that time did not include zonal management, but now will if we ever get any of these proposals funded. And very importantly, we gave them nearly instantaneous feedback on the performance of their designs. And this allowed them to get into this sort of cognitive state that we call design thinking, which is a sort of creative, activated, let's imagine a future together kind of state of mind. And you can see folks in that state of mind, actively drawing and deliberating and discussing. And they cooked up a design and for the whole watershed. And the design, in fact, makes more money and improves water quality and improves the total productivity because it features a lot of sustainable harvest of corn residue. And they really liked doing it. And the main thing that I'll draw your attention to is the big circle there, which is a quote from one of our participants. And she said what she saw was this sort of fast forward in the evolution of what has tended to be a very slow and difficult conversation, right, between conservation and production agriculture. And she lives and works right in the middle of that, let me tell you. And she saw this movement to this much more sort of, as she put it, respectful, nuanced conversation and discourse. And this, I would suggest, is what we need to move forward on these complex challenges of climate adaptation, sustainable intensification, et cetera. So we need devices and frameworks to support that kind of discourse and that kind of social learning. And I would suggest that we need these kinds of transdisciplinary vehicles to take a group like ours, our SFZM, project to the proverbial next level. And so, what I'll conclude with is the thought that interdisciplinary projects like ours are powerful. And we feel good that we've, made decent use of ARPA grant money and have teed up a lot of interesting further knowledge construction, but that may not be enough for what we are facing. And so the question becomes, can we build institutional support for some more robust, more potentially transformational context in which agricultural science can work? And if we get any of these darn proposals funded, we hope we will provide a good example or at least a lot of good learning by failure of what an effective model could really look like. So with that, I will welcome any questions and thoughts in response, and we can talk about this, but again, we have almost 15 minutes, I think, for just a general discussion to conclude the session. So, thank you. Well, I think that the thing that is really needed is kind of proof of concept work in this transdisciplinary sort of mode. So, Adam, as you well know, and I think a lot of people in this room know, many of the USDA's funding programs now explicitly call for transdisciplinary approaches. These are mandated in the RFAs. And what I think we, as the research community, need to do is to strive to be part of the state of the art of transdisciplinarity. The state of the art of transdisciplinarity is not extensive interdisciplinarity. In other words, if what we mean by that is scholars in many academic disciplines working together, that's not the state of the art of transdisciplinarity. The state of the art of transdisciplinarity, as developed by, say, sustainability science, is clearly robust, reciprocal engagement with knowledge creation workers, in other words, experts, professionals in all of the societal sectors that are necessary for change in food and agriculture, working in coordination to determine strategies and take actions. That's the state of the art of transdisciplinarity. And so we as a research community, I think, should be striving to respond to the USDA, say, and NSF. NSF has also been in their Food, Energy, and Water Nexus RFAs. They just made $50 million of investments in that area this year. I see some nods in the audience. There was pretty broad transdisciplinarity that was mandated in those as well. But again, of the disciplinary breadth. So we need to push our funding agencies to get beyond that. Adam, I think that is how we tap into the human capacity for grassroots democracy, which there's a lot of. And, you know, I think a lot of us in the room are aware that all around the world there are tons of examples of, you know, place-based multi-sector collaborations to address complex problems, at least on relatively local, at least at local scales. And so that's what the state of the art of that's the resource that the state of the art of transdisciplinary taps into. And I think that's what we need to show as academics, that we can access that resource. So Julian, then Eric.
Yeah, so it strikes me that a lot of the transdisciplinary projects that we develop now are developed in such a way that we say, okay, we need somebody from this discipline, we need somebody from this discipline, and somebody from that one over there. Let's all work together and work on a project. Let's write a project together. But what I saw as being fundamentally different, and I heard it from a number of you about your project, is that you wanted to work with each other. You knew a little bit about the way you work, you were colleagues and friends at the same time. And I think that's really an important consideration. And sometimes it happens when you put together these teams in a traditional way that you all end up working really well together. But I think what's more effective in something is building those deeper relationships and then continuing to work together on these different complex problems as a team. Continuing
that relationship. I don't, this is more a comment or a question, but I don't feel like that happens enough. And I'm not sure how to foster
that in science, but it's really, really critical that we work towards that. More posters taken from Jewish box, but just about. Yeah, I'm very impressed with your project. I think you guys have done a great job of bringing together amazing group of people and you're generating incredible science. I think the election yesterday, the results of it showed us that as scientists, we have failed. We have failed to communicate to our fellow Americans that what we're up against as a planet is real. And so I think your project and us as scientists, we have to take this issue seriously, that we have to become better communicators, not just between ourselves, but with the people who fund our research, which are our taxpayers. So I'd like to encourage you to consider taking the amazing information from your study and produce videos on it. Simple videos that translate that science into information that the general public can see, that they can grasp. You don't need a professional crew to do this. You're all effective communicators. From what I saw today, you can all sit down and, here's our paper, this is what we found, this is what we find exciting about it, here's how we think it maybe is of interest to you. I think that would set a really nice precedent. And the impact of your project several more notches than simply what we as scientists are trying to do, which is publish peer-reviewed papers in the top journals. has published some peer-reviewed video, YouTube videos on how effective and excited we are about our soil. Just a thought.
Yeah, you know, this idea of the repudiation of pollution also, like, thinks about the whole level of the system, which is that far going back and forth and back and forth in your book, but like, in a way, it's kind of a metaphor for getting off the data and the connection.
One thing I'm thinking about was yesterday was that they need something to try and get more effective communication to people who, as you said, taxpayers who actually fundamentally decide a lot of things. It's like that maybe as scientists we should be targeting less traditional forms of publication. So instead of doing more, always going to peer review journals, we should also try and peer review amongst ourselves, creating them as robust, but then submitting those to more general news outlets, magazines, newspapers, and things like this. So that it creates more of a broader interest, that I think a lot of the time are missing.
I agree. I think people are more likely to believe that climate change is true and that what we're doing to address it is real if they can see the human side effect. And then the people behind the science who are
affected
by it.
This is, of course, from my own lens, but I agree with pretty much everything that's being said and the importance of it. I'm wondering how anyone here feels like you can rectify that with the position of early career scientists, where every physician wants a independently motivated, independently working, intrinsically motivated person, whereas I personally feel like I would thrive with collaboration, but I haven't found it, and I don't see it in positions that have potentially built in from the elements of it.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't necessarily help right away, but I think that needs to change that perception. I mean, this is a complex world with wicked problems that require cooperation between teams and interdisciplinarity. And, like a couple of us in this room have just run through that gauntlet of tenure, and I for one plan to use my position on the outside of the comment to try to help some of that change. Early career scientists in the room, but I don't think that that's unique to my perspective. I think I get that a lot when I talk to my peers and colleagues, that the metrics need to change a little bit.
And I don't think it's on early career scientists to write organized. It's on us older to try to create environments in which the things that that allow some of the things that we have been espousing to occur, and you guys have been very successful in I think maintaining a position of a certain amount of independence and doing independent work, and also being very integral to our life. So, but it's not an event to make that happen.
But maybe somewhat related to that, too. I'm going to work this in here, too. And one of the reasons we wanted to have this session here at this meeting, and why we're happy to see other faces in the room, is that we're recruiting, I think. I mean, that's what I wanted to ask Rich at the end of the talk. He did such a good job of talking up our team. And you can see that one of the things we've tried to do with our team is to build the team. These grants that are very interdisciplinary, they're tackling specific problems. But the other way
time you say you did TCM in your youth or help you or you know?
Certainly helped me. Yeah, I mean, automatically my network was expanding and it just provided context for everything I did, and you can see productivity wise, you know, that all counts, you know, and so when I'm doing my head back, it's pretty good.
Yeah, I'm curious to just really value this conversation, especially like yesterday. But I think we get stuck sometimes in thinking about the way we do science, and we need to communicate less with each other, more with the public, about what helped us to do that. Certainly videos and other types of publications are important, but I think there's also, you know, what consults you're doing with it, also just that huge segment of the population that just doesn't trust or just kind of, there's just some sort of disconnect. And I wonder if, you know, maybe I'm able to kind of format and present here is a way to kind of regain from that, like what's required to be able to kind of engage with these people who are
I'll tell you what, we're doing in Illinois right now, and it's kind of peripheral, it intersects with this project, but it's speaking more broadly that we're creating what we're calling the idea of our network, and it's multiple learning communities, growers around the state. Basically, we're the FTFI committee, and we want to add on the FTFI, but in practice, on the level. But we want to be able to conduct distributed trials around the state as participatory research extension where we are working with growers, our primary stakeholders, to develop the questions and the outreach to embed it pregnant in research. And then when we do these types of transdisciplinary conversations, they are going to be at the table, hopefully building up trust, earn enough trust in partnerships. That isn't about us coming in and doing a landing and people just stop holding their cars so close to their chest. And it's just as good for the partners as it is for us. They, because of the cash rent system, are often in competition with each other. So I think that kind of building these networks can help everybody.
So I also work on how I'm aggressive in that. And I work actively more against all things research. I don't think this actually actually changes anything as far as doing good on farm transplant research. I work with folks that are evangelical Christian, right wing, and we're going to sit at the table and address their issues and crop resistance and food situation. Because I kind of mentioned it's an ahierarchical interaction. Where we're valuing their opinions and their input. If you move forward from that, the politics and stuff, bad, I understand that. But you can move beyond that for you. Nick, I had a question. Really enjoyed the presentation, but I was wondering, just to go back to the project you presented on the the idea of, it seems, of the transdisciplinary research is the move beyond just creating knowledge and helping bring about transformational change.
Mm-hmm.
And so the work that you've done there looks like you brought all these different groups together, and it's clear that you generate lots of new knowledge and from different sources. And so I don't expect transformational change to suddenly occur on that table overnight, but then from that, are you actually, from that example, seeing that transdisciplinary research is needing to change on the ground? If we expect transformational change to then opting on occur immediately, how can we sort of measure that or capture some metrics of that?
Yeah, thanks for asking. Let me just briefly sort of mention a few things. In that watershed that we have just finished a second year long workshop, that was focused on
And so, you know, those are a couple of things, Ellen, that you know, I think represent the multi-sector collective action, essentially, to move things forward. And we've had some good support from commodity groups, by the way, that have participated in workshops, which I think recognize that there's a new movement. So that commodity group engagement is, I would say, another, you know, sort of collective action. The thing that I think about a lot is how do you take things like the idea of arms, for example, to the next level? You know, because gaining political agency, essentially power for those kinds of networks, you know, how do you get this is going to be something that's somewhat related to PFI, say, or to Iowa? How does that group get more traction, you know, and get more political power? It's not going to be by itself, probably, to use a civil alliance. So there's, you know, that kind of, I guess, basically political thinking is really important, I think, to this one scenario. You can't be shied away. Can't be shied away from it. And I think that's kind of the next level of thinking for us.
Farmers represent, I mean, that farmers like farm growers or, you know, farm bureaus, and there's a lot of effectiveness that they can talk about the effectiveness that are in the community that are networked with lobbying for their representatives.
And to make alliance with those groups, too, I think. Well, I guess we're probably going.